What's up, y'all? My name is Alan Sheriff, aka Al Wonder, the Sheriff of all things innovative, and this is the ATS Podcast. Here on the ATS Podcast, we talk about all things science, technology, and psychology related, and it's my hope that I'm making the world a better place, one new episode at a time. Let's get into it. So today, I wanted to continue focusing on the psychology segment aspect of this podcast, and I thought to pose the question, what's entrepreneurship going to be doing for all of us in the future? What's entrepreneurship going to look like? How are we going to continue innovating so that we make the world a better place for all of us? And what major role can entrepreneurship play in that? And so I decided to bring on one of my old professors from the University of Maryland. He is probably one of the greatest teachers I've ever had in my entire life. His educational methods are entirely awesome. I have brought on today Professor Oliver Schlacke from the University of Maryland, a clinical professor at the Robert A. Smith School of Business, a lifelong educator, entrepreneur, strategist, and professional futurist for the past 30 years. Professor, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good, Alva. Good to see you back.
Yeah, it's good to see you too, man. You already got me nervous this morning, man. That's why I'm struggling with my nerves, because I'm like, yo, this is like the first major guest I've had on here. And like this is, I know this is going to be a really awesome discussion, because I know you always have so much to contribute. I know you have a lot of experience when it comes to the field of entrepreneurship. And it'll just be great for everybody tuning in to get your perspective on some of the questions that I'm going to be asking you today. So this is like a dream come true for me. Shoot.
All right. Good to see you back.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
It's been a while.
Yeah, it has. It's you're making me miss school already. Yeah. So shoot, let's go ahead and get into it. So basically, so entrepreneurship is driven, right, by a desire to innovate and make life better for others. Do you think there's a limit to this innovation that we might actually reach one day? And in which case, what do you think entrepreneurship will look like in the future?
So let's start with the first part. If there is a limit to innovation, and in the futurist cycles, we often like to introduce the idea of false forecast, you know, or completely bonkers forecast. And in 1899, it was the head of the U.S. Patent Office, and I think it was 1899, around that, just before the turn of that century. And he said famously, wrongly, that everything that had been invented so far, it's the limit. There's nothing more that can be invented, right? And of course, we know how that went. And so this goes almost into, you said it's a psychological class and a psychological session. There are different philosophies on that. I don't want to go too much into that, but it's a philosophy of, is there a limit to innovation? And then Are we asymptotically getting closer to that limit? Or are there no limits to innovation? But in the more practical sense, I think there are times when innovation makes just faster leaps and bounds. And it does feel for us as humans, we perceive it as very rapidly. And then there are times when the innovation happens maybe outside your view, and you perceive innovation being slower or not as fast. A great way to look at it is just to look back casting, sometimes a tool we use, but just look back how life was just 10 years ago. And then you see the enormous progress that has been made. And then we also need to be sure that innovation is not always about the next technological gadget that's out there. That's often a perception that, you know, if we don't have a new gadget, then, you know, innovation slows down. If you just look at the evolution of the iPhone, yeah, in the last couple of versions of an iPhone, there's not much new came out, right? Nothing to call home about, you know, pun intended. But then again, it's not about only those items. It's about how we do business, how we organize life. And events like the pandemic usually set new boundaries and enforce us. The fact that we're doing a podcast right now over a video connection in itself, we probably would have not engaged this 2-3 years ago, even though we had technology to do this. But now we've realize the potential of connecting with people without the necessary proximity of location, right? I did a lot of podcasts before the pandemic, and I traveled to a podcast studio. You know, I was there in person. And so we see that. That's one of the interesting things here, that we often, in order for innovation to get kicked off, some of the underlying condition need to change rapidly. And that's what we're seeing now. And I think there's going to be a lot of changes coming out after the pandemic, a lot of new business ideas. From an entrepreneurship point of view, if you look at some of these unthinkable models that we are now familiar with, many of them came after the 2008 economic crisis. You know, Uber and Airbnb, I think they were started around the time. I mean, they were around, but then the economic distress kicked in and people were looking for alternative and additional ways to make money. So I'm optimistic, first of all, that there will be a ton of innovation. And I think especially now after the pandemic is over, there will be a lot of new ways to rethink how we do business.
Yes, exactly. You know, sometimes I think of like the hilarious aspect of it when you think of like planned obsolescence, and now you have like technological masters at the center of the universe who believe like they're controlling every single innovative, like the entire innovative process. And so they won't allow us certain access to like, you know, technologies that could be like far reaching. So I'm just like, why are you holding us back? Like what's going on?
I think we need to be careful. I mean, in terms of shifting the blame, I need to be careful that we not be pushing the system that we then criticize. Gets me a little bit to the idea of, you know, the title of the podcast is Future of Entrepreneurship. And I hope we realize this as entrepreneurs, that entrepreneurship is not just starting a business, running it for 24 months and then hoping somebody buys us off. That is one of the things that worries me a little bit, because we, you know, by starting a great idea and then getting it to a point where I'm financially satisfied with giving it up and making a good deal, giving my investors a good return on investment, and then hoping that one of the large players that we often then criticize, giving them basically all the assets that we created for considerably low money in terms of future opportunity, right? There's the opportunity cost of how big could this business have grown. Mm-hmm. And so we need to think about entrepreneurship also as the way of building real businesses, not just building business models and showing that you can create a community around this, you know, get the user numbers, or creating a business model that shows a revenue possibility. I think the one aspect that I'm sometimes missing, especially here in the United States, is people are actually building a business from scratch and then to building a sustainable amount of okay paying jobs in it, right? And if we just stop prematurely often and just move away and then sell it off to the larger and larger players, we're supporting a system that might, in a funny way, like you said, some people who are pulling the strings, etc. So in order to not have this happen, kind of I appeal to many entrepreneurs, think about this more from a long-term perspective, really building organizations up, you know, getting to 500, 1,000 or more people that can work with you. And that is, you know, that is becoming more and more the exception. The norm is, I built something, I'll get the numbers up, I get a crazy valuation, and then, you know, some big company buys it. And when we look at these purchases often, we wonder, why are they paying so much for this business? And it's for them, it's just preserving their market position. Exactly. You know, it's why would a Coca-Cola, why did they pay $4.5 billion for vitamin water many, many years ago? When you do the calculation, when you look at the numbers, it doesn't make sense. But then you look at what is the potential opportunity cost for Coca-Cola to brand their own beverage in that space, and at the same time getting rid of one of the largest competitors who was already in that space, then these numbers make more sense. Still, it's a great deal for them, but we lost the independence of a brand again, right? And part of the bigger players out there. So
exactly,
gotta be careful. Right. We gotta be careful.
It's like those what's the word to describe them? Like those CEOs at some of those big tech companies who are making these purchases, it's like they see the value when they, who knows if they have like a truer vision of like what they can do with some of this technology that they purchased, but it's kind of, would you say in a way it's kind of stunting that innovation? Because again, at the end of the day, you believe that they're just doing so to help promote their market share, and it's preventing these other players from actually getting into the game, to making some of these technologies even more viable and much more beneficial for us in the long term. I mean, I kind of want to pivot to a much more interesting question, actually, because I can't help but ask, do you think entrepreneurship can only thrive within a capitalistic framework? Like, do you think that there's a different framework going forward that we could employ in order to make sure that most of these innovations come into fruition? Do you see us continuing to operate within a capitalistic system in order to make sure that our innovation continues to develop and kind of build out to make our society much, much more fruitful?
Yeah. Unfortunately, we're not in Star Trek yet, where, you know, the goal of our existence is to better ourselves, right? Mm-hmm. So there's got to be an incentive, but we're already seeing, people who operate on different incentive models. It doesn't have to be, you know, it's a redefinition of what capital could mean. Capital could not always mean financial means, but there's talk about social capital and emotional capital. A lot of people who realize that I'd like to run my business and my main return while I need to be financially viable, but I can run this endeavor also on an emotional capital, mm-hmm. And an impact capital, right? I feel good, not because I have a Lambo in my garage and flying first class in YouTubing about this, but I also, you know, create a change in my community and change in the people who work with me. And I think those things still require a system that gives us a reward. And I think whether we call it capitalistic or not, it has to be a system where incentives are created. Mm-hmm. And I don't know the name of that moving forward, but a system that does not create incentives for people, whether these are financial incentives or even, you know, emotional. And if we want this system to be geared less on financials, then we need to, as a society, need to start thinking to evaluate the financial incentives versus other incentives. We need to shift our focus. We need to highlight people. I mean, we have this obsession right now with, you know, a handful of billionaires, and whether they go to space or not going to space, that all feeds the narrative that the financial means of a person are so extremely, you know, desirable or wishful, you know. And if we don't want this, then, let's shift our attention. Don't click on the clickbait and don't listen to the billionaire who's pushing a cryptocurrency or is going into space or doing all these kind of things. You know, just don't listen to that. We have tools, and that's, I think, one of the most important tools to initiate the change if we want, is where do we spend our attention? That's a very rare capital these days. And so since all of that is being monitored and being, you know, checked in, be careful where you spend your attention. You can make a difference by redirecting your attention, and even non-consumption of content can be a strong message. If certain people do not get a million followers, if certain people don't get the exposure, that's a good thing. If you don't think it's worthwhile, just don't check it out. Just ignore them like we did before all of the social media. It was very easy to ignore people. And now we're just pushing attention around us. You know, I think it's a much more valuable currency than we often feel, you know, because it has no monetary value, but it has the value of time, the value of kind of brain power that we spend mm-hmm. on when we select what we're exposing ourselves. So.
Exactly.
Yeah. Like, I hope it's getting not too philosophical.
No, I love it. I love it. The deeper in we go, I feel like the more we learn. It's like with me, I've literally just started realizing this past couple week is that because I'm searching so much through social media feeds for like the latest celebrity gossip, I'm fueling all these arguments in my head about what that celebrity could have done or what they couldn't have done, and I'm thinking about whether or not I should take my arguments to the comment section to kind of like mm-hmm. fulfill myself in like a strange way. But at the end of the day, it's not really any of my business, you know, and it's not really like, it's not really something I should be spending so much time on. So I really like
pick something out that you find valuable uh-huh. that nobody pays attention to, and then highlight it.
Exactly.
You know, that's I think, you know, people like you who like to have this curiosity about things and are concerned about where society is moving, use that currency then that we often spend very mindlessly, but use that and highlight things that are not highlighted yet and to try to elevate them. That's you know, that's one way to utilize the great distraction that social media can be, but also it can be a very powerful tool if we highlight things that, you know, personally, and everybody has their own framework, but at least you're not highlighting somebody else's agenda or somebody else's goals, you know. So this way you have a voice and you can elevate your voice by highlighting things that are maybe need highlighting, in your opinion.
Exactly. Well, folks, y'all heard it here first. Don't listen to pop culture. Just like Professor Schlacky said, leave pop culture alone. It's all about the real stuff. The stuff that's changing, promoting people's lives. Listen to this man right here. Pop culture is no.
Well, here's the thing. You remember when people, you know, we always look at people who are fashionable, right? Uh-huh. Who are dressed after the latest fashion. Mm-hmm. Those people to me are increasingly boring. Mm-hmm. Because fashion only works by mass appeal, right? It's somebody uh-huh. else dictated, or the masses dictated a style that seems to be appreciated by many, and then you mimic it, and that's how fashion works. But to be honest, the real fashionable people, the people who are the ones who are before this time, mm-hmm. right? Who identify those trends or set the stage. And as a futurist, we always like to look at what we call early warning signals. Mm-hmm. And the more interesting to us is the fuzziness of the early warning signal that doesn't tell you yet what it is, but you get this thought that, wow, this could be something, right? This is ahead of time. And when we start listening, especially entrepreneurs, they need to have this ability to listen to these early warning signal and then amplify them and perhaps build an economic model around this. But if you want to be in that space, you cannot go with what's going on, with what's fashionable, with what's being communicated on a mass scale, because that means what is there communicated, it was new a couple of months ago. And so we need to, for entrepreneurs, it's essential to have this ability to see something before it matures, before mm-hmm. it gets into the mainstream. And this is wherein the risk lies, mm-hmm. right? You have to have this gamble of putting your finger on something that nobody yet knows how this turns out. But you and your energy and your ability to communicate and the ability to organize around this hunch, this is the exact way of building interesting businesses. And so by definition, I would tell every entrepreneur, don't listen to what is currently on, because before your idea is ready for this market has already moved on, right? There's a few ideas that take no time to be implemented. Even if you see a fashionable idea right now and you want to, you know, jump on that trend, by the time you're ready, by the time you're getting into the market, that market has already passed and there's something else coming. So in order to do that, a small business, yes, can be agile, they can be quick, but it's still not enough. You need to find out, where do I find the information that is telling me what's next, right? Where and this could be, you might find this in another geography. Most of all, you find it outside your comfort zone for the most part, because the comfort zone is where everything is nice and predictable. And so you need to get out and you need to find people, you need to talk to people that are on the fringes and interact with these more early warning signs.
Exactly. Well, for the sake of the financial future of this podcast, I will be taking the opposing view of Professor Schlacky, and I will fully endorse the fashion industry and all these other trending industries.
No, you
going
should.
On
I mean, this is.
I'm just kidding.
This is mind pop. This is mind popcorn, right? It's easy to see, but you know, watch fashion that is not fashionable yet.
Yes, usually exactly. Awkward,
right?
Yeah, but you do make a really good point about the fact that a lot of these trends, they're kind of forced upon us every single day in the media, and we have a hard time trying to be able to find our own distinguishing unique ideas or being able to have our own foresight about things that we see every day in society that we could, you know, kind of build out and develop into our own and kind of provide something new for society. But that was just a joke. I mean, I love pop culture and fashion, but hey, I mean, at the end of the day, everybody has to be able to think for themselves to a certain degree and be able to, you know, try and look at some of the innovations or some of the different things that you see going on in society that you feel like you could transform to make beneficial overall for everyone. So I definitely love that point that you make. I just want to ask one more question before we go, because I know we've run out of time here, but I was hoping you could quickly address the question of, is entrepreneurship an innate talent? Like, can you be born into it? And like, or do you think it can be taught and will be taught in the future? For will it be developed into do you think it could be further developed education wise? And it can be taught to various people in the future.
Well, if I'm not tapping myself on the shoulder, but you went through two or three classes that I taught at least.
And I love that.
You're doing it. But I don't think I think entrepreneurship is not a subject matter like potentially other topics. I think it's a mindset that we can develop, right? And along with this mindset, we have to see what prevents people to adopt this mindset. And what I can see in entrepreneurial education that, in my opinion, has a lot of merit is to use the time that we are in school to create an environment where our students can experiment with various aspects of getting this mindset. Let's start with, you know, start with the social risk of entrepreneurship. The risk to tell your parents after college that after studying a more formal subject, you decided to go on your own and build your own gig, right? There's a social pressure there where not all parents, but some, might say, hey, that's what we paid for. You could have done this without college. And I want to argue against that. I want to see, depending on that college, they might be right. But if you go to the right college, if you go through the right education, you can, I think it's more valuable to learn a mindset in college than it is to learn a subject matter, because the mindset is longer lasting and might be even more impactful. So if I define it as a mindset, then I need to ask myself as an educator, what can I do to do this, to showcase this mindset? We can do this by showcasing other people and how they arrived at this transformation. you know, how they do this. We do this a lot. But also we can create an environment in which we can practice it more, you mm-hmm. know, be more realistic and have students experience the life cycle in a fairly safe environment, at least socially safe environment, where failure or, you know, a redoing of their idea is at least free of financial failure and free of emotional failure, mm-hmm. so that we can encourage students to start something and then maybe they have the wrong assumption and it doesn't work out. But that is part of the appreciated and desired outcome, mm-hmm. Among others. Because I'd rather have students fail, quote unquote. It's you know, I don't think it's failing. It's just failing if you don't learn from it. But I like to learn these experiences while it's in a kind of a safe environment where we can, you know, the environment does not do harm so that they decide, I'm not going to do this anymore. And I think that's where we as educators, as universities, we have to be diligent to get that mindset aspect into the teaching. And it doesn't mean that we all students have to start their own business in college. That's just one way to do this. But exposure to this mindset, the shifts that are involved, how to explain to yourself that this is a career more beneficial and valuable for you. I think that's key. And most of my class designs now and then hopefully future designs that get better and better involve students to find ways to understand that mindset, appreciate this mindset. And if they're not ready for that at this point, at least know what it takes and have this. I always say entrepreneurship is the best plan B you have for your life, because it's it requires very few people giving you a thumbs up or allowing you to do this. This is one of the universal I'll take my chances type of activities. And that's why I would love to have at least every student who goes to MITRE, even if I don't teach entrepreneurship, but I want them to see this as a potential plan B at some point in their life when the circumstances ask for that.
Well said. Well said. I love that. Would you like to tell people where they can find you?
Well, you can find me at the University of Maryland at Smith School. Contact me at oschlake@umd.edu. And especially if you have strange and weird ideas, there's nothing more I do to help out, to share my thoughts on business ideas. Actually, thanks to Zoom, a lot of people contacted me, and I actually enjoyed the last year and a half, you know, in a strange sense, of course, but it allowed me to connect with so many of my former students who found found that this mindset of entrepreneurship might be right for them moving forward. And so I was able to help and share advice and get involved in a lot of ways, you know. And I always say, and Alvin, you know this, for me, the interaction between me and former students just starts when you graduate. Mm-hmm. Graduation up to graduation is just, we're getting warmed up with each other.
I'm in the real world now, man. I'm in the real world.
We didn't let each other's let go of each other, so that's good.
That's really good. Exactly.
Yep.
Hey, Professor Schlake, thank you so much for coming on again today.
Always.
Really appreciate it. You're awesome. Hopefully we get the chance to do this again. Shoot.
All right.
Thank you so much. Awesome. Thank you.